So I'm going to talk tonight about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So when we enter our shrine room here, first thing we see is this very imposing image of Buddha Shakyamuni. And then also there are quite a number of other Buddha and Bodhisattva figures around here. Vajrasattva, Padmasambhava, Amitabha, the two Taras, Akshobhya, Manjugosha, peaceful Vajrapani. Quite an array of figures. And there's probably going to be more in time. And many of you have been doing the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice, visualising the refuge tree of the Triratna Buddhist order. Again, the largest figure on the refuge tree, where it's depicted here, is Buddha Shakyamuni. And then there's the smaller figures beside him of Dipankara, the Buddha of the past age, and on the other side, Maitreya, the Buddha of the coming age. We have Bhante and his teachers. Some of those teachers who are regarded or have been regarded as bodhisattvas, if not living Buddhas, by their disciples. We've got the five archetypal bodhisattva figures on a lotus to the left as we look up. The Dharma text, the Arahants, the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. And then above, in the sky above, the great teachers. Some clearly historical, and some like Milarepa, Padmasambhava, Nagarjuna, Shantideva, hovering somewhere between the historical human and the archetypal. And above them, Vajrasattva and the five Jinnas, colourful, archetypal Buddha figures. So already we have, as it were, in our awareness, in our field of consciousness, many figures. And if we look at the richness and diversity of the Buddhist tradition, we can have a sense of many more behind these, around these figures, many more Buddhas and Bodhisattvas behind them. So the central place of Buddha Shakyamuni in our shrine room on the refuge tree is very significant. He is our Buddha, the discoverer or rediscoverer of the way for our age, for our world system, the one who opened up the way to enlightenment for us. So in terms of doctrine, teaching, image, he, Buddha Shakyamuni, is our touchstone, our reference point, against whom we can check and measure all that followed, all that developed in the Buddhist tradition. And I'll come back again to this point. So even within the Pali texts that tell the stories of the historical Buddha and of his life and teaching, numerous Buddhas of the past are enumerated, as well as Maitreya, the Buddha of the coming age, the one who will reopen the path to enlightenment when the present understanding of the Dharma, the path, has completely disappeared. So from the very beginning there's been this understanding that a Buddha is not unique, that Buddhahood could be seen as a potential, a possibility inherent in the universe that can arise whenever the appropriate conditions avail, though it's never inevitable. So the Mahayana gave this understanding vivid poetic expression, speaking of countless Buddhas in countless world systems. And in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, we meet Buddhas such as Meru Pradipa Raja, in whose universe there exists some of the finest and most superb thrones in the whole cosmos, and such as Sugandhakuta, who teaches through food and perfume. Figures that might seem to us like the creations of a playful spiritual imagination. And then in the Sutra of Golden Light we meet Buddhas such as the Lord Ratna, Kusuma, Guna, Sagara, Vajura, Karnaka, Giri, Suvana, Kancha, Na, Prabha, Sri. It's quite a good name to threaten somebody with, isn't it? If you don't behave yourself, that's the name you're going to get when you get ordained.
What's it mean?
Find out when you get given it. So how do we begin to understand, make sense of, you know, all this, all these Buddhas and countless Buddhas in countless world systems and these remarkable figures, you know, with great stacks of thrones and teaching through perfumes and so on. Well, Buddha Shakyamuni didn't worry about it. He mentioned past and future Buddhas, but he maintained what Bhante, in revering and relying on the Buddha, speaks of as the Buddha's metaphysical reticence. The Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni, Gautama Buddha, refused to get drawn into speculative views around Buddhahood. As when, early on in his career, he was asked, well, what happens when a Buddha dies? Does he exist? Does he not exist? Does he neither exist or not exist? Does he both exist and not exist? And the Buddha's reply was, even now, standing in front of me, talking to me, you haven't even begun to understand who I am, what I am. Never mind when this body, this human form, disappears. So he just swept away, you know, any possibility of speculation and discussion around it. He says simply, I teach the path to freedom, the path to liberation. Follow my teachings. This is all you need. No time for endless speculation and views. Later Buddhists, though, couldn't resist coming up with explanations and speculative understandings about the nature of Buddhahood and Buddhas. So they spoke of the Nimanakaya, of the Buddha in human form, historical form, and then of the Dharmakaya, of the essential nature of enlightened consciousness behind all or beyond all definition, beyond all form. And later, interposed between these two, the Sambhogakaya, Buddhahood as experienced in meditation, beyond the everyday world, in subtle form, imbued with beauty, light and meaning. And there were similar developments with the Bodhisattvas. Originally, there was just one Bodhisattva, just this one being set on enlightenment, who was the Buddha to be, Buddha Shakyamuni to be, in his previous lives and before his enlightenment in his last life. But with the Mahayana and the emergence of the Bodhisattva ideal, we have the Bodhisattva as a practitioner dedicated to enlightenment, to the attainment of Buddhahood, not just for his own sake, but for the sake of all living beings. So on the one level, we have the Bodhisattva as a human practitioner, human practitioners who wanted to assert or reassert the importance of compassion, the other regarding dimension of the spiritual life, you know, to really insist that it's not all about a personal nirvana, that such thinking is a contradiction in terms. There can be no selfish transcendence of self, or no self-centered pursuit of self-transcendence. And there were also some scholars who have pointed out practitioners who they simply took their own practice very, very seriously. They set themselves the goal not of just gaining enlightenment, but of actually becoming Buddhas, of opening the way to enlightenment for others. And they just held to that in a quite literal way. You know, they were the ones who were really going for it, you know, in a completely uncompromising way. Others might just go for enlightenment. They were going to become Buddhas and save all beings. In time, other figures belonging more to the world of the imagination, the Sambhogakaya forms emerge, these other Bodhisattva forms. Some of them may have evolved out of yakshas and protectors, local gods and goddesses. And they often became associated with particular qualities of the Buddha, the enlightened mind and consciousness. So Avalokiteshvara emerged somehow as the Bodhisattva of compassion, representing that quality of compassion in the Buddha's mind. Manjugosha, above all, the quality of wisdom. Vajrapani, energy. Vajrasattva, purity. Though all of them contained at the same time all those qualities of the Buddha, but giving a particular focus to one aspect of it. And then there are others like Padmasambhava and Milarepa, who again were on this shifting ground between the human, historical, and the mythical archetypal. And over the centuries, there was a proliferation of such figures in various traditions. And some of them still, even today, hover on the borders, the shadowy hinterland, where it's not completely clear how far they've been fully transformed by the Dharma and how far they still are possessed or represent powerful, unregenerate energies. And Bhante is certainly quite dubious about some of the animal-headed and wrathful figures of the Indo-Tibetan tantric tradition, and definitely has a sense that they are, you know, very much in this shadowy borderland and maybe rather too far, if you like, on the side of those unregenerate energies. And just, you know, as a sort of example of something in this world going on. It's like quite strange, perhaps, to many of us. But you may have been aware of a conflict between the new Kadampa tradition, one of the Western, more Western Buddhist offshoots of the Gelugpa tradition, and the mainstream Gelugpa tradition. And you may have heard of followers of the new Kadampa tradition even disrupting the Dalai Lama's talks and ceremonies. Now, even in the UK, I think there was he was doing some sort of ceremony or initiation in Oxford, and he had to abandon it because of the protesters. And all of this actually stems around a figure called Shugden, who's a sort of bowler-hatted bodhisattva figure, whom one of the Tibetan oracles at some point declared had gone over to the dark path, you know, that he was not to be trusted any longer. So he, you know, he'd been, if you like, a benign figure, but now in some way he'd gone wrong. And so the Gelugpa hierarchy banned the practice of Shugden. And this caused a very strong reaction from many of the Shugden devotees, including the leader, the Tibetan who was the leader of the new Kadampas. And it seems, now this has been going on for many years now, and I was hearing that in India, some Tibetan monasteries in the Gelugpa tradition have been divided in two, you know, half for the Shugden followers and half for the non-Shugdens, for the conventional group, and or even new monasteries have been built side by side. So very powerful passions have been stirred up by this debate over this figure. And to us, you know, it all seems strange, bizarre, but to those immersed in that world, it all seems to be of immense importance. Whilst, I mean, you know, it also cuts so much across this whole project of bringing Buddhism to the West. You know, there are Buddhists of one tradition, you know, disrupting talks and so on by the Dalai Lama. You know, it's a strange world, you know, where people have got so involved with some of these archetypal figures. And Bhante clearly doesn't want us to go down that road of proliferating interest in ever more exotic figures and all the complexities and confusions that can arise. So, you know, sometimes, yes, in the course of our reading or whatever, we come across some strange, exotic figure that nobody else has sort of heard about, and yeah, we can start to think, oh, I'd like to have that as a practice. But Bhante's also made the point, even if we seem to make a powerful imaginative connection with one of these figures, that doesn't actually necessarily mean at all it's a spiritual connection. And what he's actually saying he'd like us to do is really just draw in, focus on a small central core of Buddha and Bodhisattva figures, which actually, you know, just from those I listed at the start and which we see around us, isn't actually that small. And just really seek to enter deeply into connection with them and the qualities they embody and represent. At the same time, recognizing that they all go back to the historical Buddha. All the qualities they represent, embody, are present in the Buddha, are present in Gautama Buddha, present in Shakyamuni. He remains our touchstone. So it's so important that we really know the Buddha, know the stories of his life, know the stories of his teachings. You know, recognize that the compassion that he gave expression to in his remarkable life is, you know, exactly the same compassion that the Mahayana holds up and encourages us to live by and practice. And so, yeah, we really do want to be familiar with the Buddha, really familiar with the Pali Canon and with the historical Buddha. And certainly in some traditions, the historical Buddha has receded into the background. So, you know, for example, in the Tibetan Nyingmapa tradition, Padmasambhava seems to occupy the central place rather than Buddha Shakyamuni. You know, Buddha Shakyamuni is sort of somewhere in the background. In the Pure Land Buddhism of Japan, the Buddha Amitabha has taken the central ground. Or in Nichiren Buddhism, it's Nichiren and the Lotus Sutra who very much occupy the central ground. So it does seem very important in bringing and establishing Buddhism in the West, we really keep the historical Buddha firmly in the foreground in terms of doctrine and in terms of our faith connection, and just really avoid all the historical and cultural distortions that have come about over the centuries in the Buddhist tradition. Just read you something here that Aloka, who painted all these pictures we see around us, wrote in an article he put together just about this project of creating new Buddhist images for our shrine room and for the movement and for the future of Buddhism in the West. So Aloka says, Bhante has managed to slice away all the various ethnic manifestations that for many constitute Buddhism itself. If we're prepared to study the material he's made available to us and practice it, then the Dharma could be a living influence on this disaster-prone planet. The visual language that is part of that, the communication of the Dharma, also needs to be viewed in this radical way, with one major difference. We're not the inheritors of any living tradition of Buddhist iconography. What we've inherited is different cultures' preservation techniques. It's quite an interesting point, isn't it? You know, it's like that what we've got isn't something that's sort of alive and emerging. It's something that's been sort of become set over centuries as a way of preserving, a way of passing on images of the Buddha. So Aloka continues, it's possible to breathe life into the relics of past traditions through the vitality of our own practice. But ultimately, our own system of practice needs to give birth to its own forms. From the historical point of view, the time needed for a more indigenous visual language to develop when the Dharma moves into a new culture or geographical location seems to take about 200 years. The modern world has only been aware of what it terms Buddhism for about 100 years. So the process has hardly started and will not fully flower in our lifetimes. But the emergence of an indigenous visual language needs people to practice the Dharma deeply. The images will not burst forth fully formed by themselves. Neither can they be thought out by some kind of committee. And elsewhere he said, as I've said many times before, if, as a movement, we don't eventually give birth to our own compelling symbolic forms, we won't survive as a vehicle for the Dharma. So, bearing this in mind, we have the centrality of the Buddha. And you could say what we need to try to do is really be in touch with the living spirit of the Dharma, with the Buddha's teaching, his wisdom, his compassion. And over time, out of the depth of our practice, allow for the emergence of new forms. And we can see how this can work. You know, Avalokiteshvara emerged in India as an embodiment of compassion. But then when Avalokiteshvara moved to China, he became transformed. He became transformed into Kuan Yin, and then later into Kanon in Japan. Sometimes a male form, sometimes a female form. So, like the Chinese, the Japanese mind, spiritual mind, reimagined compassion in the form of Kuan Yin and Kanon. So this is something that we can hope that we can look to enable to happen in the West through our own practice. So obviously this doesn't mean that we all go free form and follow our whims and fancies. We really need to go very much more deeply into our connections with the Buddha above all, and the existing Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you could say, that are alive in our collective imagination, in the order and movement. Just really deepen and intensify our own practice, our engagement with the Dharma, and just see what emerges over time. So we work with these inherited forms, but we're receptive to our own emerging spiritual intuition. Not too rigid and literal minded, you know, it must be just so. I was in St. Petersburg a few years back, and I met a young Russian who'd been training with a Tibetan tanka painter, and he'd been shown exactly how he had to do everything in terms of the tanka painting. You know, there was a certain way in which he had to prepare the colours, you know, grinding up turquoise for the blues and different stones, and everything had to be done in a very ritualised way. And then every detail of the painting had to be done according to a specific formula. And he was really working very hard to try and, you know, just follow the tradition as he'd been taught. And he was quite taken aback to see some pictures of our locust paintings that I showed him, and didn't quite know what to make of it, you know, because he felt he was trying to pass something on and work with something, and here was somebody else who seemed to be breaking all the rules. And it is a very interesting sort of creative tension we must work with, if you like, between established form and creative freedom. I think it's something we need to work with again and again in spiritual life, you know, with the teachings, making them our own, sort of working very carefully with the forms, but then also not being limited ultimately and defined, constrained by the forms. There does seem to be something. Well, I think it's sort of in artistic activity as well as in the spiritual life, maybe in life altogether, this tension between form and creativity. Yeah, and we're going to just have to see what unfolds over time. There's other interesting questions around this whole area So, you know, for example, do the archetypal Buddha and Bodhisattva figures really exist? The historical Buddha certainly seemed to exist, you know, in a conventional sense. You know, there was a man who taught and so on, became a Buddha. But then, what happened when he died? Well, we've already looked at his refusal to go down that line and give us any glib answer to that question that might only end up, you know, making us more confused. I was telling people in my group this morning about something I read some while back, an account of Lawrence Venderpost in his book of the Bushmen of the Kalahari, and a trip that they made to some sacred caves. And they got the permission of the elders of the Bushmen to go to these sacred caves. So they went off on this expedition, some Land Rovers and so on. But they'd been given a special condition. They mustn't kill any animals on the way. And the first night they made camp. They were going to these mountains where the caves were. They made their camp. And one of the bearers, one of the African servants, shot a deer, which is, I think, what they usually did on these expeditions. He'd not been properly warned. So, you know, this was exactly what they'd been told they shouldn't do. But nevertheless, they continued. And the next day, as they were driving along, these swarms of wasps came along and got into the Land Rovers. One of them went off the road and overturned, and they all, you know, had a pretty scary close shave. So they aborted the expedition at that point and went back. And when they spoke to the elder again, he said, "You were lucky. You know, 10-20 years ago, you'd all be dead. But the gods are losing their power. You know, our culture is being destroyed by the inroads of your Western cultures and the modern world. You know, so the gods don't have the power they used to. But yeah, some time ago you'd all be dead." So, you know, just have a sense of something very mysterious, sort of alive in the collective psyche. And you can have a bit of a sense of that, you know, so Avalokiteshvara in Tibet is a sort of patron saint of Tibet, and there is a real sense amongst Tibetans that he's a sort of living force amongst them. And you know, the Dalai Lama is seen as an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. They're not the only one. So, yeah, we can have this sense, you know, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they can be somehow, mysteriously, in a way, alive amongst us, out of, growing out of, alive because of all those sort of centuries of practice and so on. But, yeah, what sort of force? Again, I think there's no point in getting lost here in speculative opinion. Just, well, maybe ask, what place does Avalokiteshvara or any of these archetypal figures have in my life, my spiritual life? What place, what influence in my practice? And maybe even more importantly, not just the figure, but the spiritual qualities they embody and represent. You know, what place does compassion have in my life, in my spiritual life? Well, wisdom, you know, with Manjugosha and so on. Just exploring this whole question further, in the paper, Reimagining the Buddha, based on conversations with Banti over recent months, Subhuti speaks of the philosophy of as if. So for everyday purposes, we behave as if there's an actual world out there, also out here, of independent objects, people, chairs, floor, podium, all the rest of it. But when we look at it objectively, you know, really look into it, well, what there is just a flow of sense impressions and interpretations that we place on them. You know, how can we ever know that you see and experience, you know, the same things as I do? There seems to be a sort of overlap. It all works, but how can we ever know that we're actually seeing the same colours, the same objects. It seems to work, and we get by. I mean, you know, like we all have our own slightly different eyesight and sensibilities. You know, a dog lives in a world of smells. You know, he may be sort of walking along the same path as us, but he's in a different world. Or the hawk, you know, with its incredible eyesight. Again, its senses define and create a very, very different world. So we just can't really be sure that we are actually experiencing the same world. But as if seems to work. Yeah, we get by. And it can be the same with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You know, we have an imaginative engagement with them, the qualities they represent. And it seems to work in terms of helping us, helping people make possible a rich and unfolding spiritual life. You know, we can behave as if they are real, as if they really do exist. And in a way, it's not so different, not such a different as if from the as if we assume about everything. Though, of course, all of this in the context of a living spiritual community, a context of faith, of practice, understanding, so it isn't just, you know, silly superstition. So there are these sadhana practices given at the time of the private ordination, the point where one ritually and formally commits oneself to the three jewels, to the spiritual life, with one's private preceptor, and one does it again with the public preceptor in the public ceremony. But it's in the private ceremony that one receives the sadhana practice, or at least the mantra connected with it. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattva figures we meditate on and visualise, recite the mantra of, engage imaginatively with, cultivate the felt presence of, they represent all that is highest and best. They represent the potential for enlightenment in ourselves. And we evoke their presence, their felt presence. But it can also seem at times as if they are a real present out there, having an effect on us. You know, not just a creation of our imagination, but actually another subject like us, having an effect on us, blessing us, lifting us up towards them, out of our present limited mode of being, into a much more expansive, beautiful way of being. And their forms and gestures and implements, their garb, all speak to us, communicate living spiritual truths to us that can take us beyond ourselves. So there's something strange, mysterious, wonderful that goes on. And we can speak of their influence as, in terms of the grace, the love of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas descending on us. But it doesn't just happen, it grows, it unfolds in a particular context. You know, in traditional Buddhist countries, we could say it's in the air, in the atmosphere, in a whole way of thinking and being. But for most of us, it comes out of a long process of practicing the Dharma. Maybe having to overcome certain attitudes and prejudices and assumptions coming from a previous religious, Christian or background, or maybe a sort of materialistic, atheistic background. You know, we have to, as it were, learn a whole language, a whole way of thinking and being. We practice ethics, meditation, we study, we do puja and devotional practice. And along with this, we slowly cultivate this sense of an imaginative connection with the Buddha and with the Bodhisattvas, but above all with Buddha Shakyamuni. So again, returning to Subhuti's paper on reimagining the Buddha, this brings out Bhante's emphasis on the crucial importance of the faculty of the imagination, a faculty that we all have and use, but maybe in a quite limited way. So we need to recognise and value and cultivate this faculty, which brings together intuition, reason, experience, understanding. We could say that it's there, this faculty of the imagination is there when we engage really empathetically with others. It's there when we really engage with nature and open ourselves to, you know, the sort of beauty and awesomeness of nature. It's there when we respond to beauty in art, in music, in poetry. And when this faculty is engaged with our highest values and aspirations, it becomes Shraddha, and eventually it becomes Pranya, wisdom, a direct knowing and seeing of things as they really are. So it's a faculty that supports and helps bring about this profound reorganization of our being, so that we are living more and more in accord with the true nature of things. And it's a faculty we can cultivate, recognize and cultivate, and that grows with a deepening understanding and a living experience of the true nature of the Buddhist path. But it isn't all or nothing. It's not that you have it or you don't have it. You know, it may come and go. It may be more alive on retreat and when conditions are really supportive. And it can just grow quite quietly and steadily and even catch us unaware at times. You know, I certainly couldn't have spoken in this way about the imagination and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas a few years ago. You know, something grows and develops in one as one enters into this world of the Dharma. As we move more deeply into the Dharma, you know, we can have this greater sense of mystery, wonder, strangeness as to what the Buddha and Buddhahood really are all about. So we use our reason as far as we can, and we need to be as rigorous and clear as possible in our pursuit of right view, you know, cultivating a really clear and precise understanding of the Dharma, the teachings and the practices. But we also have to keep stepping increasingly out of the known into the unknown. And the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, the Buddha, offer themselves as intermediaries, as bridges between the world of the known and the mystery of the Dharma, the truth beyond all words and concepts. So rather than just talk more about the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, I'm going to finish now by just inviting you to enter with me, with faith, imagination, into the world of one of the great Bodhisattva figures, Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of great compassion supported by the deepest wisdom. So when we go to encounter Avalokiteshvara, we enter into a vast, radiant, deep blue sky that extends above, below, all around, into infinity, in every direction. And we ourselves are just vibrant energy in the midst of this vast blueness. And out of the depths of the blue sky emerges a beautiful white lotus flower. And floating on that lotus, a moon mat, radiant white. And then seated on the lotus, on the moon mat, is the form, the beautiful form of Avalokiteshvara, all made of light, self-illumined, radiant, beautiful, a beautiful youthful face, eyes so kind and wise, smile so compassionate. He has four arms. Two of them gently cradle the Chintamani, the shimmering jewel of the bodhicitta, at his heart. Whilst in his other two arms, He holds up at either side a mala, a crystal mala, and a beautiful lotus flower. And he's dressed in shimmering silks and jewels. The jewels of the perfections adorn him. Whilst across his left shoulder is the skin of a black antelope. And around him, radiant auras around his head, an orange aura of light, and around his whole body, a blue aura. And above his head, the vast, beautiful form of Amitabha, Buddha of infinite love and light, the colour of the setting sun. So as we imaginatively identify with Avalokiteshvara, his mantra sounds, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And we look up in devotion with Avalokiteshvara to Amitabha. And the love and blessings pour down from Amitabha, pour down through us, through the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, out into the world, bringing us into connection with profound empathy with all beings, wherever we meet them, whoever we meet, we respond to them out of love and compassion and wisdom. We meet them. We see clearly how they limit themselves, how they're caught in suffering. And as that love and light and wisdom of Amitabha flows through us, there's that response out of wisdom of whatever will best help them, free them from their suffering. So we rest in that wisdom and compassion of the Buddha as it manifests through Avalokiteshvara, manifests through Amitabha.